What will happen when artificial general intelligence arrives? What is the nature of consciousness? How are music and creativity pathways for reconnecting us to our humanity and the natural world?
Dustin O'Halloran is a pianist, composer, and member of the band Winged Victory for the Sullen, winner of a 2015 Emmy Award for his theme for Amazon comedy drama Transparent. He was also nominated for an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and a BAFTA for his score for Lion, written in collaboration with Volker Bertelmann. He has scored music for Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette and choreographer Wayne McGregor for the Royal Ballet in London. With 6 solo albums under his name, his latest album, 1001, is available on Deutsche Grammophon.
Dustin O'Halloran, welcome to the Creative Process on One Planet podcast.
Hello, nice to be here.
So we're here to discuss your new album, 1001, with its thematic exploration of nature, consciousness, technology, and artificial intelligence, of course, implied in the title that suggests a binary code. Can you just discuss the organizing principle of the 4 parts of the album?
Well, it started as a dance piece with choreographer, dancer Fukiko Takase. And we had met when I was doing a dance piece with Wayne McGregor with another project that I do called The Winged Victory for the Sullen. We did a piece called Atomos. Fukiko was one of Wayne's principal dancers, and I just loved how she was able to express in movement. It was a very profound experience to realize how connected music is to dance, and this sense of communication without words and how it gets elevated when you bring dance and movement into music. So it was something that I really wanted to collaborate with her. And when she eventually left Wayne's company, there was a chance where she had time. And so we started talking about it. And the first discussions that we had about working on an idea was we started discussing this old anime, The Ghost in the Shell, which sort of touches on these ideas. It was sort of early concepts of mind-body dualism and the idea of technology and consciousness. And we were commissioned by Liquid Music Series, which is Kate Nordstrom is the curator. And we first performed it right before the pandemic. And it's only had one performance as the full dance music experience. Then the pandemic came and we had many other performances booked and it got taken out. And then I was left with the music, and it was a really interesting process because I had never really gotten into this conceptual side of creating music. And the fact that I thought there was just so much to mine in this subject and the ideas there. And so eventually I decided to work on it as a record and sort of create an album experience out of it. So I came back to the material and started expanding it for the record. And it's broken up into 4 movements. And it's meant to be a kind of journey. It's meant to be something that you can listen to from beginning to end and experience it as a whole, which was my hope, and probably demanding a lot for this period of time where people are taking bite-sized bits of information. I thought, in a way, it's also goes into the concept of where things are going, our relationship to technology. So I wanted to see if I could create a space that people could dive into and experience something as a whole. It's really like a journey from our connection with nature into where we are now in this moment where we're playing with technology. We're almost in this hybrid space where we are not fully understanding where it's going. And it's very deep in our subconscious and probably much greater than we realize. And it sort of ends in this space where the consciousness of what we're creating, it's going to be very separate from us. And I believe that's kind of where it's heading. And the idea of losing humanity, losing touch with nature, and becoming outside of something that we have created.
It really does come across. And it's interesting because I recently had a conversation with a paleoanthropologist, Ludovic Slimak, who wrote The Naked Neanderthal. And he was discussing the possibility of our own extinction. He says that the Neanderthals were possibly more creative and more intelligent than sapiens, and that sapiens were just hyper efficient. And it's very interesting because with 1001, you're looking into the deep past and we're at this threshold looking into the future. He says that at a certain moment, this technology will evolve and become super efficient and smarter than we are, like you said. And that moment, our children could simply reject everything that makes us human, and our society and maybe that of our humanity could collapse on itself. And with this generation that's growing up, and I know that you're a new father and you're perhaps reflecting about next generations who are growing up alongside the development of generative AI. And this generation may look at ours as embodying old values that are no longer good enough for the future. So what will we retain from our present and past, and what will we preserve going into the future? These are very important questions.
And I think it's really, it's a crossroads between knowledge and wisdom. And I think that wisdom, for me, is so connected to nature and the information that we get from nature. We ultimately are part of the natural world. Knowledge of knowing things and facts and these kind of bits of information doesn't necessarily mean that we are going in the right direction and we know things. In this space, a lot of wisdom is being lost. And I find that, going back to what you were saying, that's being connected to an earlier time. I feel that's true. Language is being diminished. There's so many things that are being diminished in this moment. And yet we're creating something that is going to have vastly more knowledge. But this is where it splits. And what is the idea of consciousness? Where is wisdom something that's external? Is it something that is more related to quantum physics and in the quantum world than just the physical body and the physical brain?
Indeed. And in the writing of the slow development which happened during COVID, I'll just say personally, there are many kinds of intelligences, but I'd always equated, let's say, the imagination, creativity as being the most important one. You know, what are you adding new? And it seems like every 6 months I've had to reanalyze my perspective, because a lot of the creativity that we thought was unique to us can also be pretty closely replicated.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that AI, you know, we've sort of thought it was going to go into this manufacturing, robotics, like these were the first things that were going to go. And I think when all of a sudden music and art started to come out, it was a wake-up call to what is our purpose and like, what are we bringing to humanity, to the human story? And I think it's interesting because a lot of artists now are concerned about it. But I think, you know, what are we? What is the value of our consciousness? And consciousness, it's been something that I've been reading about. It's a vastly understudied part of science, and it's going to become very relative very quickly. And I think that it's getting to the core of creativity. What is creativity? And ultimately, where do we want to go? How are we going to connect with each other?
And so for you as a composer, a musician, and I think that for many people who are working, that their body is part of their creative process. It's not just in the intellect where we always assumed it was seated in the brain. I mean, yeah. Your consciousness is moving around your body, or maybe as you're working with dancers or other collaboratives, or in a room, you talk about nonverbal. Some people think this is esoteric, but that consciousness can exist in a kind of cloud that extends beyond us.
Yeah. And in making this record and with the dance, I didn't use any AI or I didn't use anything in the creation of this. The idea was to create just a perspective that's very human. And I feel that something that is unique to us, and this idea to be reflective and even critical on itself. And I think that it's trying to find that the magic that I think exists in human creativity. And I wanted it to be very much human made. So every element is very analog in a sense. And all of the parts. I mean, I use electronics, but I also use them in a very analog way.
So would you be open in the future? You know, because I'm very resistant to, you know, I just don't want to feed it anymore. And also you value your own judgment, right? So I'm just wondering, would you be open? Because sometimes, you know, as artists, we can kind of mine the same track. And I know when I listen to your music, I will say this is a departure from a lot of your music, but I feel like it's very instantly recognizable. But would you be open to suggestions sometimes, you know, to see like, what do I not understand about my own music that someone else, a digital mind, an AI mind, might be able to reflect back to me?
Well, it seems like the creation of music and AI, for me, it doesn't seem at a point where it's giving me back anything that I find really interesting. Maybe it would be interesting in the sense of if it was doing something wrong or it's glitchy. I think that these images that were coming out of early AI where they're really distorted and they're not correct, I find that really interesting. And the more advanced it gets and the better it looks, I find it less interesting. So I think it's those middle grounds where it's confused and making mistakes where I think that's where people can pull some interesting ideas from. I'll be curious to see how it advances, especially on the music side. But I'm not really that concerned right now because I feel ultimately people want human stories and people want to connect. And I think that it's such a powerful thing and it's moving so quickly. And just in the short time in my lifespan, it's happened. And my generation is the last generation to remember a world without internet. And what that was like, and what did we do with our time? What did we do with the in-between times? And I think a lot about people growing up now and have no idea that there was moments where you could be bored and your mind would wander and what you actually access in those times and how important it is. There's so much happening right now. And I think that it's a very interesting time, even if there's a lot of concerns.
Yes. And the extent to which everything that we do is in some ways tracked or measured, I think the amount of data that is stored and being collected is doubling every 2 years on the planet. And I wondered what that does to you sonically. I know, of course, you live in Iceland now, and I wonder how that vastness and the volcanoes, you are able to go out and maybe not have silence, but to have that conversation with your own imagination, the natural world.
Yeah, I think for me, Iceland's been really great in that sense that there's so much going on and things are speeding up so quickly. And Iceland is very connected to nature and you can't really escape it here. It's just around you constantly. And it doesn't take that long to get into just a vast open space. And I really appreciate just the space I feel in my mind. And I feel like there's a lot less noise. And for me, that's really good creatively. I think that having these huge natural occurrences like volcanoes and this incredible wind that happens during the winter, all of these very elemental properties, for me, I love it. For this moment in time, it's been really good.
And could you discuss also some of those other sonic landscapes that I see? You grew up partially in Hawaii, Los Angeles. I know you spent a long time in Berlin and Italy. You know, how did they inspire you?
I think every place is been a part of my story and a part of my music. And I feel it when I listen back. Maybe it's not so conscious in the moment, but I've moved into so many places in so many countries in my life so far. And each one is very distinct.
My father had a scuba dive business in Kauai. So I grew up scuba diving since I was about 8 years old. And that was a pretty big impact on just my early years of experiencing nature and especially being under the water and the way sound moves underwater. Sound waves move much faster in water. So whenever you hear something, it sounds like it's all around you. And I've been lucky enough to hear whales sing and dolphins. So that was a great way to grow up and experience this whole part of the natural world that most people don't get to. Nature that I think is most profound is that it's always truthful. And I think that that's something that always resonates with me. Whenever I'm in raw nature, there's just an undeniable truth and a sense of how it's supposed to be. And I think that that's something that I reach for in my own music and where I try to take myself out of my own single being, out of it, and try to be in touch with all of it. And I think that that's just something that's so resonating in nature, of a sense of wholeness and connectedness. When I'm writing music, I don't think I'm ever specifically trying to capture any of these moments specifically. I think it's just the way your mind works when you're in nature and the way you're able to hear yourself and be at peace, really. So there's always this very strong connection to creativity in nature for me. Lightly. It's a piece that I wrote in Italy that seemed to resonate with a lot of people. And yeah, you know, these are just like moments where you're tuning into something.
There's a sensibility with the culture, especially the food that's around you, the people, just the climate also, I think, has a big effect.
Italy, it's a very fertile place. There's so much that grows there. And I was living in a place not far from the Apennini Mountains. And I spent a lot of time up there hiking and exploring. And it's hard to say specifically like how it finds its way into the music, because I think that the land that you're on, it all resonates in different frequencies. And there's just a certain energy, I think, to every place that you are. And there's just so much beauty there. It can be a really stunning, beautiful place. Also, a piece I don't know could have happened anywhere but Italy is a piece entitled Opus 20. And that's maybe a bit more romantic in some ways, but it's, you know, it's an expression of, you know, there's a lot of big love in Italy in the people. And I think that's a piece that I don't think I could have written anywhere else but there. And in contrast, Iceland has a very stark beauty, more intense, but equally breathtaking in a way.
Iceland is very cold most of the year, and you spend a lot of time inside. And people always ask me why there's so much great music and art in Iceland. And I think a big part of it is these months of darkness that you experience. And you're sort of forced to create an inner world that's big if you want to feel good here. And people do that. You know, that's a big part of, I think, you know, creativity is the core of consciousness. And, you know, it's such an important part to understand that the relationship to ourselves and where do those sparks come from. And like you said, I think there's a kind of global, a universal consciousness of creativity. I think in our best moments is when we find silence, and those are the moments where we're able to tune in to grabbing these ideas that are bigger than us. And I think I always find that those are the moments where you really connect with other people, because I think people internally feel that universal connection.
A piece off of Silfer that I think kind of shows a distinct difference in tone and landscape is Constellations number 2, which I wrote with a cellist here, Gita Valtisdottir. Somehow the nature here is so dominating, and it forces you to engage it, but also to go probably more inwards in a way, because it's something that you can't always be out in it. I think there's a sense, there's such a amount of space. Somehow I feel that it affects me in the way that I want to reflect more space as well. it's a place that I don't feel I want to compress so much density into the music. And I think that that was something that is more evident on 1001, that I was really trying to find this balance between the negative space and what I was creating. And I think that's something that living here is definitely influenced me.
Yes, it's quite sad. You have all that beauty. And yet, according to NASA says that Iceland is now losing 10 billion tons of ice each year. So you must reflect on that and the loss of glaciers since you've been there.
And there's a glacier that years ago, they demoted it to, it wasn't a glacier anymore because there was so much loss. And they actually have a plaque on the mountain for the loss of the glacier in Snæfellsnes.
It's funny you mention that because I interviewed Andre Snær Magnusson, who wrote that poem on that plaque, and it's really moving. It reads, "A letter to the future. Oak is the first Icelandic glacier to lose its status as a glacier. In the next 200 years, all of our glaciers are expected to follow the same path. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it."
You know, being in a place where you can actually see it happening is pretty intense because there's so many people are living in big cities and they're pretty disconnected with what's happening in the natural world.
I'm very interested in your writing process. You don't score it until you've performed it. It's a transcription of what has been performed.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a very tactile musician and using my ear a lot. And I sort of go in blindly and eventually find my way. And then after that, then I'll get it into some sort of transcription or for other players. That's why I love the piano, because you can do so much with it and you can explore so many ideas and even think about other instruments. But it's purely analog. It's just you and the instrument. But it's always born through some kind of improvisation and just trying to find those moments where you're in tune and something comes to you. You're downloading the information.
As I understand, you have a kind of synesthesia?
Yeah, I've always, it's funny, I didn't really think about it or think that it was strange until I got older and I realized that I was always thinking of colors when I'm writing music, and it was always seeing colors and wanting to put colors and textures together. And that was something that I've always followed that rather than thinking of music in a mathematical way. And so when I started learning about it, I just sort of thought everybody experienced music that way.
I know that you came up through art and you were a visual artist.
When I was younger, I did a lot of drawing, but I quickly gave it up once I found music. It just felt so much more natural. And I don't think I was ever a great artist. I was, you know, looking for a way to express myself, but I've kind of come back around and gotten into photography. That's something that I really love to do when I have time.
So, you know, I first came to appreciate your music, I think it was through the theme of the television show Transparent, which was so wonderful. I'll just give you my interpretation. It opened up like this perfect music box where, along with the initial video, I think anyone can sort of understand what it is to have this kind of private self, your real self, and the one you portray in the world. And I think it opened up for anyone that they might understand about having a dream deferred. This is how I felt. It just opened it up, the story of a transgender woman and her family's personal journeys in a way that I felt could be understood by all.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a really, really nice project to work on.
Just tell us your approach to that, because I think it really opened up that conversation about transitioning for the wider public.
Yeah, well, Jill Soloway was a friend of mine for a long time, and I was living in Berlin, and she was doing a lot of writing, and she was passing by and she said, "Hey, I've got this idea for a series and we're working on the first episode and I'd love to show it to you." And we met and I watched it and I loved it. I thought there were so many dimensions to it. And she had been using a bit of my piano solos as temp. And then I just thought, well, maybe I should just, why don't I just do it? And then we just started getting into it. So I think it already had a connection to the music that I write for myself in a way. And somehow that just worked and connected. And I think that especially those two piano solo records, I mean, there's so much about time and your internal world, and there's a sense of longing and, you know, a bit of open-heartedness that's there.
Yeah, it really runs throughout your work. And you talked about dance elevating music, or I think elevating each other. But I think that definitely made that story one that could be experienced by those who might have closed minds towards people who are transitioning. So as I understand, your first foray into scoring for film was Marie Antoinette. And that, again, was growing out of your own music, not scoring specifically to the scenes.
Yeah, I just finished my first solo piano record. And it was a record that I really didn't plan to release. It was something that I was just recording for myself. And I wasn't feeling incredibly confident about the recording or the performance, but there was an atmosphere there. And the label that I was on at the time, Belly Union, it's a British label, he really wanted to release it. And so we put it out there. And that's when I got in contact with Sophia.
That's Sophia Coppola.
And there was the first piece is this counterpoint piece that's has a bit of a counterpoint Bach-ish vibes. And I think they probably weren't sure that I would, you know, if I was a living composer. But then her music supervisor got in touch with me and I ended up writing a lot of music. And that sort of started the whole second record, the volume two, which I was just writing in Italy on this old upright for many months. And I ended up with much more material than they needed, because in the end they used three pieces of music and she basically gets music before she finishes the edit. And so she really edits to the music. So while they were filming, she had sent me a kind of a mood book of photographs and ideas. And she was looking for the innocence of Marie, these sort of early parts of her character. And I was exploring that. It was a really nice film to be part of. I think it still stands up too. It's one that I think has aged well.
And so this unusual, I think that you had this freedom. I guess it depends on which director you work with, because I think that you had freedoms, but I think that when you were composing for Lion, you were really responding to particular scenes and particular images.
Yeah, Lion, when we got involved, there was a pretty early cut. So that was a really different experience because it was a bit of both. It was trying to get into the picture and what would really work with the scenes. But also I had to sometimes just put it away and just really get to the heart of the film too, because there was a big overarching feeling to the film, the feeling of home and the feeling of being connected to your mother and this cosmic connection that was calling him to find her. So there was moments of getting into really taking these bits that we'd been working on outside of looking at the picture and then making them work inside the picture, which is a lot of work. It's actually hard to kind of take something and then you have to fit it into a box, because film is a bit of a box. It has limitations and there's time. It has to hit marks in time, which when you're making music for yourself, don't have to worry about that.
Yes. And so sometimes, because if you talk through some of your other projects where you've composed these pieces and they're used for other purposes, they find their way to another scene than you've specifically maybe been thinking of.
I think that's when magic things happen, is when you write a piece of music and then it just hits moments that no one is even recognized and it pulls something magical out. That's actually my favorite way to work, is having a piece of music sits in a picture and it just pulls something out that neither me or the director expected. I think that Ammonite was a really nice film. There's very minimal music in that film, but he wanted us to, the original idea was to create one piece of music that would have variations through the whole story and then come together at the very end. But I wrote this piece of music without picture at all. And it was one of those pieces that just sort of created some magic with the picture. And once we started putting it in.
Yes, it is magic. I have to say that I dance to that almost every day, but just in a very amateur way, because I think that what's beautiful about your music is about longing and memory, but it has these elemental qualities and it's full of images. I could feel the wind passing through the leaves, or I could become the river dancing. And so I think that's a great gift to the filmmakers and also the choreographer that you work with, that it can pull them along and open up other pathways in their imagination.
Yeah, well, I think that's the special part of music, is that it connects on so many levels, and especially instrumental music is so international and universal. And I think it connects the mind and the body in a very special way.
You have, you know, different stages in your career and you haven't always been working with instrumental music.
Yeah, I had a band for many years with the singer Sarah Love, and we did 5 records. Belly Union was the label we were on, and we did a lot of touring in Europe. And that's basically how I ended up staying in Italy. We were recording a record at the time, and then I decided to stay. For me, that was my formative years in music. I didn't do conservatory or go to music school. So it was a real hands-on sort of education of touring and writing music and exploring sound. And I think that's something that I've always carried with me. Also, that's when I started getting into recording and learning to record myself, and the idea of how just the process of recording is such a big part of how music is experienced. When I was in Italy, I connected with an engineer named Francesco Donadello, and He has ended up being one of my lifelong collaborators. He's just an incredible engineer, and the way he thinks about sound and recording. Basically, since we met, he's touched everything that I've done, all the records, and helped me record them and mix. And when I moved to Berlin, he eventually moved to Berlin as well and opened a studio. And then he started working with Johan Johansson and Hildur Guðnadóttir. And he's just incredibly special human. And I learned so much about recording. When you're translating music, ultimately, it has to be in a format to be listened to. And how much care you put into it, it can help just create a depth for the listener.
And we should also mention one of your most frequent collaborators, Brian Senti.
Yeah, Brian Senti has been a great collaborator. We met at Sundance, and I was trying to remember which film I was there for. I think it was Umrika, which was an Indian film that I did. And since then, we've done a lot of collaborating. He collaborated with me on some of the last seasons of Transparent, and we've done some series together, a series called Save Me, and worked on our own music together. And the first part of 1001 was born out of a moment when I was in Los Angeles, and we were just working in a kind of improvisational way. And we just hit a space that I just felt was very special. And so we sort of took this long improvised piece and slowly kind of condensed it or carved it out into an actual form. But he's an incredible composer and amazing violinist.
Hi, Dustin. How are you?
Yeah.
This conversation is wonderful. My creative signals were going off the entire time. When we were talking about nature and creativity and just vulnerability, I think is a really important part of creating things. I think to be human is to be vulnerable. One point that I often think about is art is often glamorized. I danced for many years. So this conversation about dance with Mia talking about she dances to your music, it was really beautiful to me. I think that people often forget how vulnerable and emotive art is and creativity, especially with live performance. For me, I felt that way whenever I performed on a stage. So I was just wondering if you feel that way with live performance. Do you feel more connected to the audience or to yourself creatively?
Yeah, I like what you said about vulnerability. I think that it's such an important part of making music. I think about it a lot. I think that ultimately, when you're creating art, you can't really think about what it's going to bring to you or the glamorization of it. I think it's a path that can inhibit real connection. Vulnerability, ultimately, we are all vulnerable. And I think that's when you're really hitting this real connection. The last tour that I did in Europe, it was interesting because I hadn't been performing a lot with my other project, The Wing Victory for the Sullen, but I hadn't toured in a while. And I was really touched by this sense of connection, that feeling, especially not having played in a long time and realizing that people had spent time with my music and that it meant something to them that wasn't about me, my person. It was just about their memories and their emotions. And that, I think that's really beautiful that when you get outside of yourself and everyone's just experiencing something that means something to them, but in this communal way. And I can't say that touring is my favorite part of making music, but this last tour made me realize how important it is and how important that connection is. And we're only in this space and in this time for a limited moment. And I think that it's nice to share it.
Yeah, I think that this sense of glamour that we were talking about with, you know, just dance or music, acting, I think it's a real disservice to the craft. I was in London last summer and I went to see a play and I realized while I was sitting there how incredibly human it is. And I think that's often very overlooked, especially with dance. I mean, I felt that way. And it's interesting talking about Italy and Berlin. I was born in Germany and I was actually just in Rome last summer as well. And I was feeling very creatively sparked by just everything I was seeing. But also, I kind of wanted to talk about this idea of the distinction between knowledge and wisdom and the knowledge of the digital mind. So I found there's a certain anxiety relief with harmonic dream sequence that I felt. But I understand entering the age of AI was inspiration for this. So do you think that there is a certain comfort in blurred consciousness or this sort of hive mind mentality? with AI?
That's a good question. I think there's a fascination with it because obviously it's reflecting humanity back to us in some sense. It's the first moment that people probably feel like they can have a real conversation. I mean, you can go onto ChatGPT-4 and you can have a very in-depth conversation with it. Of course, it's fascinating and it's becoming highly advanced. I think we're just in this moment. It's this shiny object that we're fascinated with, and obviously people love getting their own image reflected back to them in some way. ChatGPT-4 feels very complimentary the way it's designed. You know, if you put something into it, it always makes it sound much bigger than it is. For me, I think that it's ultimately going to be, you know, where we're talking about knowledge and wisdom is we're coming to the crux of what is consciousness and what does it mean to be human and what does it mean to be creative. And if machine learning can be, you know, I'm putting up quotations, creative, like how do we connect with each other? How are we connecting? What do we have to bring? If a machine can do the things that we can do with this record, the idea is like, does consciousness live in the body or is it something that is external from the body? And I think the conversation is becoming much more real as quantum physics are developing and they're understanding that reality is not what we think it is. And it's starting to become real in the scientific world. And they're starting to take consciousness much more seriously in studying it because that's going to be the real crossroads. Because if knowledge and it's just knowing things and it's just a series of data that can be processed, I don't think that really quantifies the human experience. And I think that's, for me, maybe that's the good side of this advancement of AI is it's going to make us look human consciousness and realize that we're capable of so much more and we're capable of connecting on a much, much deeper level. So I think that, you know, it's going to be a moment of reckoning.
To be vulnerable is to be human, and our art reflects this. Whether that be through music, dance, acting, we pour our emotions and our experiences into our craft. This can be a scary thing, especially in a world which glamorizes the arts so heavily. Dustin puts it beautifully, people want human stories, not this false persona inhibiting our consciousness with a muddy notion of humanity or this romanticizing of creative vision. Camera flash, click, click, click. Who are we? What do we need? And how do we connect with each other? To come to the core of what is consciousness is to confront these areas of darkness we all experience, to confront ourselves, facing inward in hopes to create an inner world that's big, in hopes to reach another's mind and heart, in hopes to be understood. Creativity is the embodiment of humanity, and what is beautiful is often scary. To be vulnerable is to be human. Let us celebrate this rather than cast it away. Let us dance with the sound of the running river stretch and bend like a sticky sap-covered tree branch. Create music with the sound of a robin chirp. My name is Hannah Lumi. I'm a student studying communication and media studies, creative writing, and philosophy in New York City. And my creative process is enhanced by this notion of what it means to be truly human. Now, back to the interview.
It brings us back to indigenous wisdom with this concept of earth mind. I spoke recently with the biologist and plant physiologist, Rupert Sheldrake, and he's had this old theory about morphic resonance, positing that our consciousness could be out there. And he says that memory is in nature and that natural systems inherit a collective memory from all the previous things of their kind. I mean, certainly we can see all kinds of alternative, nonverbal ways of communicating in the animal world, like when you watch the murmuration of starlings or among more collectivist societies. He says we could be communicating telepathically, which I don't think is really that strange. I think for artists, you know it as artists. You're in the process of collaborating. You don't have to say it. You just pick it up in the room, right?
And indigenous wisdom, there's so many indigenous people who have combined plants and pharmaceutical companies have come and taken their knowledge and made synthetic drugs from this knowledge. And they always ask, the indigenous people are told that they've just been given the knowledge from the plants, you know, from nature. And I think that's becoming a more real conversation is this transference of wisdom and where does it come from?
It's always nice to have a little bit mysterious. And I think that is where art comes in to help us feel and bring us along so that we can tune into the music of plants or the music of the universe. I'm wondering how becoming a father may have transformed your perspectives and your relationship to your art and music and time.
it's affected it in every way. I think that when you see a life starting and you realize how a mind develops and a spirit develops, and that you're the caretaker of these early years of how you can help this person along in life, that's had a really profound effect. And especially thinking about this moment in time where there's so much distractions, so much information, there's so many screens everywhere, and how it affects the development of the mind, and trying to keep connected to nature, connected to this part that I think is vital to human development. And I, of course, just like all of the things that the future holds, climate change and what it all means. You know, right now, I mean, there's people in school studying things and they're probably wondering if they even need to study it because AI will be doing it. And so what should we be learning? I think wisdom is going to become a very, very powerful tool for us to use. And I think that it encapsulates spirituality, creativity. We're going to be pushed into thinking more in an esoteric way because the knowledge of things and the practicality of things are going to be done. I think that having a kid is really just bringing all that to light. And it's very real because there's a whole life that has to be lived.
Yes, not knowing what that future holds as we're being introduced into a synthetic realities, which may be, you know, further development, a new consciousness, a silicon-based consciousness. I was wondering, as you reflect on your earliest musical memories, I know that you kind of self-taught, so you found your way into music, but how we might be sharing music with Isolde, your daughter?
Well, my mom was a dance teacher. And that was really my first, connection to music, was hearing the piano player. She was teaching ballet and she was taking classes as well. And I was always sitting around in the sides and there was always a pianist playing. And I think that was first time that music was really resonating with me and inspired me to want to learn. So I had some early lessons in the beginning and then I just took it on my own. When I was young, I didn't have a piano. And so when I finally got back to the piano, I just started getting into it on my own. But it was definitely with my mom and these early dance classes and just being around it. And I think that always made me connect the sense of just movement and music, dance and music.
And perhaps prepared you for your work of collaboration with dance and film and television. And so I know you've also collaborated with your partner. I wonder what that experience is like.
Yeah, Herthis, Stefan's daughter, my partner, mother. She's a wonderful composer, a creative force. And we've collaborated once on a series for Apple, The Essex Serpent, Claire Danes and Tom Hiddleston. And it was a great experience, actually. I'm really proud of the work we did together. There's a lot of music, 6 episodes. It was great. She did a great job and I really loved working with her.
I wonder what that process of like harmonizing with your partner's musical soundscapes.
I think we're very different in our process and our music is very different. I think there's a core of where we connect and perhaps how we feel music, even if it comes out differently. I think we're both instinctual, I would say, in our approach.
And so how can we, passing on this instinctual relationship to music, and arts education is one that's really neglected. You're lucky if you've grown up around your mother and her dance studio and this kind of thing. I mean, how would you like to modify some of our current educational models that really embraces this kind of knowledge as opposed to STEM fields are really pushed a lot these days?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. My mother was very open-minded and didn't really get in the way of how I wanted to express myself. She was just encouraging and just helped make sure that I was around the tools and the things that I needed to do it, but gave me a lot of space. And so that was just my experience. I don't have the conservatory experience, which is, you know, a much more probably analytical, mathematical way of approaching things and technique, and which I value highly. And I've had to do a lot of work on my own with trying to catch up with some of the technique that I didn't get in the early years. But I think ultimately, you know, with education, I think it's just, you know, I think moments of creativity that are just, it's hard to put it into words, but where you just, you know, we're just very free. I think you just, ultimately, that's what I had growing up. So I feel like that there's a lot to be mined and just getting to understand yourself and having the freedom to create without judgment. I mean, maybe that's where it is. It's like, you know, I think the idea of being graded on art gets really conceptual because ultimately it's when you feel unjudged and you feel free, then I think that's when you can really get in touch with interesting things.
Your music feels very free. So when you're talking about collaborating with people who've had that conservatory training, what they bring, their sensitivity of touch to your music.
You know, I've been lucky to work with some incredibly talented people. Clarence Jensen is a cellist that I've recorded with a lot and toured a lot with. And she is a highly skilled player. She's a composer. And I'm always in awe of her abilities because she definitely has access to just so much knowledge. But she also just has this incredible sense of just getting in touch with music in a almost spiritual way. And she can just whenever she plays, she just takes me somewhere else. And I've been lucky to be able to work with people like that. And it's something that I think helps elevate what I'm doing, because there will always be a threshold that I will be up against with my own knowledge of the things that I didn't get to learn. And so collaborating with people who have these incredible skills always is a real pleasure.
Yes. And you've said your favorite space is in the studio when you're experimenting. And then maybe you can tell us a little bit about that process.
Yeah, I think ultimately, if you want to be a composer, you have to really enjoy time alone. I think if you were a writer, a painter, it's probably the same. And I really enjoy that. The studio space is a very sacred space for me. It's a place where I can explore ideas. I spend vast amounts of time alone here. And I use the studio like an instrument too. I think that I think because of where I came from with playing in a band for a long time, I learned this idea that the studio is also an instrument. And I think that, you know, artists like Brian Eno or like people who've used the studio as a form of exploration, that resonates with me, because the surrounding myself with interesting instruments, playing around with old synthesizers, guitar pedals, I just getting into the concept of like, what is sound? And it's not just about notes to paper for me. It's always a mix of both. It's like, how can I record this piano piece, but also record it in an interesting way, or a way where you're close miking it and getting really deep inside the piano and you hear artifacts and things that are adding to the experience. So I use the studio is both a place to work, but it's also a place for me to explore sound, and it helps me write.
And I wonder, because being in Iceland, of course, these other places where you have lived, Hawaii, having these rich natural resources that you can mine for sound, do you keep like archives where you're getting inspiration from these little bites of sound around you?
Yeah, I mean, there's moments where there will just be something happening that I'm not sure how I got there, and then I will record it. Maybe I'm working on something else and I happen upon a really interesting sound space. Maybe I've got a collection of pedals running through a synthesizer, going through a tape delay, or it's like something's happening, and I'll keep these little bits, because every little, especially sound, when you get these interesting sound bites, that they're like little seeds that can grow whole pieces of music. And that's something that with the Wing Victory for the Sullen, that's something that we work in that way a lot, where Adam creates these sounds with his guitar that really doesn't sound like a guitar. It just gets into this space. And so much of our work sometimes will just be on these little bits of sound that he's created, and then we'll work with that.
It's so exciting to think about how all those little pieces developed over time. And it comes to us whole and something that we can just respond to. So, you know, as you think about the future, the importance of the arts and the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, I think music has the power to create a strong sense of empathy. And I think that's probably what we need more of. Music can really help foster. You know, music is a universal language. And I think that there needs to be a point in time when we need to recognize that we're all living on this tiny planet, which is a speck of dust in the universe. And we need to feel that. That's what I hope.
You mentioned some of your important collaborators over the years, but as you think about those teachers, and you mentioned your mother, and, you know, what do they pass on that's been important for you?
Well, I think that there's been many forms of teachers in my life, but, you know, some of them have been friends and colleagues. And I've been lucky enough to be around some people that are very inspiring. And I think that we're all, you know, we gravitate towards the things that are meaningful to us. And I think that, you know, obviously everything starts with the mother. And, you know, I'm grateful that she imparted in me this desire and strong sense of creative freedom. And I'm grateful for that. and then meeting people along the way that I think I really admire why they make music or why they make art. And I think ultimately, like, those are the people that I connect with the most, is people who are creating things for the right reasons, I guess, that their intentions are clear and true. And I think that's what I hope I can find in my own music.
Well, you definitely have, and you've helped us find it in our own creative spaces. Your music really helps us touch our empathic imaginations. So thank you, Dustin O'Halloran, for inviting us into your imaginative world and opening our mind to these important questions about what it is to be human, the nature of consciousness, and helping us appreciate the liminal spaces between wisdom and knowledge, time and memory. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you. When I made this record, I was really hoping that it creates interesting conversations for people, and people get to think about things that they don't really think about normally with just listening to a record. So this is really fun. Thank you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Hannah Lumi, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The music featured in this episode is Somatic Love Spiral, Harmonic Dream Sequence, and Spiritus Naturae Aeternus from the album 1001, Opus 18 and Opus 20 from Silfer, We Move Lightly from the album Lumiere, and Constellation No. 3. Music is courtesy of Dustin O'Halloran and Deutsche Grammophon. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Hannah Lumi. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.